Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app, Star One Credit Union, in your best interest. Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the California condor. With a nearly 10-foot wingspan, the condor is the largest bird in North America, flying at speeds of 50 miles per hour and as high as 15,000 feet in the air. But for more than a century, these birds have been absent from Northern California. Until this year. The success of captive breeding programs has allowed these birds to be reintroduced to the northern wild and will meet the Yurok tribal members, scientists, and government workers who brought them home. Join us. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome to Forum. Condors are flying across Northern California skies again after 130 years, thanks to the work of the Yurok tribe and federal and nonprofit agencies. While their numbers have grown slowly and steadily in Central and Southern California, after dwindling to barely more than 20 in the world in the 1980s, reintroduction to the wild in Northern California eluded these magnificent birds until this year. Joining me now to talk about the decades-long effort to return condors to the Redwoods and Yurok ancestral territory are Tiana Williams-Clausen, director of the Yurok Tribe Wildlife Department. Tiana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the invitation to be here.
Joe Burnett is also with us, senior wildlife biologist and California Condor Recovery Program Manager at Ventana Wildlife Society. Joe Burnett, really glad to have you as well.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
So first, Joe, can you remind us what a condor looks like? They're pretty fierce when I look at the images.
Yeah, you know, I think that's probably one of the more, I think when folks look at it, you know, they look like vultures, you know, they don't have feathers on their head and, you know, the baldness on the, and the bright red color and, you know, they're feeding on dead things. I think they definitely conjure up these images, but you know, what we, when you start working with the birds and start observing them, there's a beauty that is just undeniable, you know, that kind of shines through. But yeah, that rough exterior, there's definitely a lot more to the condor than just what meets the eye.
Tiana, do you remember the first time you saw or encountered one?
Oh, absolutely. It was actually with Joe. We'd gone down to Ventana Wildlife Society to both receive some training in condor monitoring and tracking and handling, but also to help with construction of one of their facilities. And like Joe said, it's particularly they are gorgeous in motion. I was standing there on the slope and this huge shadow passed in front of me. Of course, it draws the eye right up. And I saw this absolutely beautiful and gorgeous creature flying maybe 15 feet over my head. Wow. And I heard this zing as the wind passed through its feathers. And it was just an incredible experience.
What does the condor mean in Yurok tradition to the Yurok?
So condors, Preganish in the Yurok language, tie very closely to what we consider to be our foundational reason for being, which is as world renewal or fix the earth people. People who are bound to keep the earth in balance. And that means the airs, the waters, the wildlife, our spirits and all the spiritual components of the world. It's our job to keep things healthy and well. And our relationship with condor goes all the way back to the beginning of time, when before even humans were really the people of the world, and it was the spirits like condor who were helping design how we would move forward in a good way. And so condors contributed to our role as world renewal people, teaching us how to be good people. as well as many other lessons. One of them that's actually taught to us is, from Condor, is he has a very strong and kind-hearted spirit, which is an important part of renewal. And that spirit is much more important than his physical exterior, which some people may mistake for as his important thing in when they first see him. But no, it's really the spirit that matters.
Yeah, we asked listeners to finish the sentence, California condors are. And one of the things that we heard were gentle giants. And I guess it makes sense, Joe, in the sense of they have these teeth that are capable of ripping away flesh, rotting flesh, but they're gentle in the sense that they don't actually hunt or kill, right?
Yeah, they're obligate scavengers. Yeah, with that beak and those strong neck muscles, they can render flesh from, you know, carcasses that are left on the landscape. And really, you know, their role is nature's cleanup crew. I mean, they can go out there, say, you know, in Big Sur, I remember in 2006 when they found their first whale carcass, you know, it was a historic moment. That was the first time we'd seen them feeding on whales since Lewis and Clark's time. And so it was this moment. And then you just saw the relationship, the natural relationship they had with the ocean as well, and what it provides. And they rendered that whale, they fed on that whale for 4 months. And, and it provided for them as a flock at that time. And they were a younger flock at that time. So it was amazing to see that relationship reconnected, you know, Tiana's kind of hitting on it. These relationships they have not only with, you know, with that, and then they're feeding and then they're nesting with redwoods and, you know, which are so prominent up north, also prominent in Big Sur. But yeah, this relationship they have with redwoods is also pretty incredible, and just the whole environment. But yeah, nature's cleanup crew, boy, you need them.
Yeah, what an image. I'm wondering what they sound like. What kind of sounds do they make, Joe?
You know, they don't have vocal cords, but interestingly enough, they make kind of a reptilian sound, like what you'd hear from a snake, like a hiss. So if another bird is kind of pushing another bird around, the bird getting pushed around will hiss back and strike at the, almost snake-like, at the other condor. And they also make a grunting sound. I'm not that good. I have some folks on my crew that are really good at imitating it, but I'm not going to try right now. But guttural. So yeah, very primal type sounds. But most of their communication with each other, they're incredibly social. We call them, you know, we joke about them as flying primates. They're so complex, and these long relationships they have with each other. And so their language is mostly nonverbal. You know, they change the coloration of their heads. You know, and someone asked me, what's the color of a condor head? I said, well, it depends on the mood. You know, it's like, you know, they're scared. They kind of flush like humans do and get real pale. But when they're happy or in breeding season, they're bright. You'll see purples, pinks, you know, yellows. And of course, they do a elaborate courtship display. And they're just amazing. I mean, I just feel really lucky to be working with them as a biologist. And I'm continually fascinated by their, not only their intelligence, but just the way they communicate, the way they interact in these long social bonds. I mean, you just can't help but identify with that, you know?
Yeah. My understanding is that our producers, Grace and Susie, have procured a condor sound for us to listen to. So let's hear that recording now. Wow, we are listening to California condors and talking about a decades-long effort to return condors to the redwoods and Yurok ancestral territory with Tiana Williams Clausen, director of the Yurok Tribe Wildlife Department, and Joe Burnett, a senior wildlife biologist and California Condor Recovery Program Manager at Ventana Wildlife Society. And you, our listeners, of course, can join the conversation. Have you ever seen or encountered a condor? What are your questions about condors and the condor reintroduction? You can email forum at kqed.org. Find us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram at KQED Forum. You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. So, Tiana, talk a little bit about the condors that were released in Northern California. How many were there?
So we were blessed to receive four condors, juvenile condors, about 2 to 3 years old from the rearing facilities at the Oregon Zoo and the Boise World Center for Birds of Prey. So we had three males and one female who we successfully released this spring for the first time, meaning for the first time in over 130 years now. Yeah. Condors are free flying in Yurok skies again. So that was a really incredible time.
And what can you tell us about each of them? I understand they have names that are reflective of their way, their personality.
They do. So we consider condors to be, if not equal to humans, then potentially even superior species because of what they teach to us. So we understand that they probably, in our understanding, they probably have their own language. They probably have their own names for themselves. But it's a very traditional indigenous thing that as you come into new milestones in your life, you're provided a new name by the community you integrate with. And so we provided them, I'm calling them nicknames, but So our first was Poitwasan. It literally means the one who goes out ahead. He's a leader. And that was given to our bird A3, who was the first one out and actually ended up just booking it away from the facility and spending 2 weeks on his own. The second released was his good bud Nesquichok, and that means he returns, indicative of the overall return of condors. But he himself took a much more reserved approach, flying only a little bit away, but then coming back to our facility every night to eat at the proffered carcass we had there to keep them close to home so we could observe them. After that, we released our first female. Her name given was Negem Nichwing Ka, which means she carries our prayers. And so that actually references one of the traditional roles that condor plays for us, which is carrying our prayers across the world when we're asking for the world to be in balance. And then the last released was Pla Halet. And that means that either we or I finally fly free. And that's of course a reference to all of our first cohort actually flying free together. And also the fact that poor A1 that was the last one to go and had to wait the longest. So that's our first four birds.
Oh, beautiful. So with these four, Joe, where does that put basically the number of condors that are now flying in Southern Central California, I believe in Arizona too, or Nevada, as I understand it?
Yeah, we're well over 500. And I think Ashley will have the exact numbers for us, but well over 500, you know, from the 27 that when they brought them all in 1987, the last free flying condor was caught. We're well over 500 and roughly 300 in the wild between Arizona, Southern California, Central California, and Northern California.
Well, and when you say Ashley, you mean Ashley of the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife, who'll be joining us later. First, though, I want to read a couple of comments from our listeners. A listener tweets, "Condors are absolutely amazing. They almost look prehistoric to me. I'm not going to call them giant buzzards, though. I hope I can see one fly over me one day." Another listener writes, "Honestly, condors look terrifying, something like a dinosaur with wings. But this show is making me love them more." You can share your thoughts on condors, what comes to mind when you think of the California condor, if it means something special to you. You can email them to forum@kqed.org. You can post them on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum. And you can always give us a call. Our number is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. More after the break. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
At Star One Credit Union, you're first because they put you first. Ranked number one in the nation for direct financial benefit to their members 10 years and counting. Star One invests in your best interest with the latest banking technology, an authentic human experience, and effortlessly simple, everyday banking solutions that put you first. They also believe in giving back, donating to over 70 Bay Area organizations annually. Become a member at StarOne.org or drop by any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Let me tell you what we're talking about on Monday. We'll be talking with Adrian Hahn, a game developer. But he says watch out for the points badges and leaderboards and things like that that aim to make exercising, learning, or your jobs more fun. While they're all part of our gamified modern life, they're also, according to Hahn, an insidious form of behavior control. Hahn joins us to talk about his new book, You've Been Played. Today, we're talking about the California condor, which this year was reintroduced to Northern California by the Yurok Tribe and their partners. And we're talking with Tiana Williams-Clausen, director of the Yurok Tribe Wildlife Department, and Joe Burnett of the Ventana Wildlife Society, a senior wildlife biologist there in their California Condor Recovery Program. And we're talking with you, our listeners. You're telling us if you've ever encountered a condor, what questions you have about them, or what comes to mind when you think of the California condor. And let me go to caller Nicole in San Pablo. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Mina. Thanks for having me. I am just so excited for this conversation. I was leading a youth group trip in Pinnacles this past spring, and we were hiking the loop and came on some hikers who turned around and gave us the hush finger because there was a condor, and if my memory serves me correctly, it was tag number 40, and he was just up there with his wings spread, sunning himself, and it was to be close enough to a condor to see the tag number. They're majestic, they're graceful. And then I have to shout out to the volunteers who worked to track them, because about 3 years ago we had spoken with a volunteer and he just took an incredible amount of time talking to the young people about the condors and the role they play in the ecosystem. We ran into the same volunteer again this past spring, and he said, oh, yeah, tag number 40, that's a young male. He's too immature to be mating, so that's why he's hanging out over there. And just so grateful for the education that they provide on the spot to anybody who stops and asks about them. And thank you as well for this conversation. It's wonderful.
Well, Nicole, I'm so excited for you that you got to have that experience. Joe, do you know tag 40, the condor 40?
Yes, I do. Yeah, thank you, Nicole. I'm glad you ran into the volunteers. So one of our close partners is Pinnacles National Park, the National Park Service. They started releasing in Central California to join our effort. We are located on the coast. They're inland. They joined the effort in 2003 and have been just such an incredible partner. And Pinnacles itself is such an amazing place, as Nicole described. And this bird she saw, I'm guessing it was 840, if it's a younger male. And he's, since then, he's now coming of age a little bit. He's definitely not breeding age yet, but he's an up-and-comer. And yeah, again, these birds, you know, they have these long lives. You know, they reach, you know, breeding maturity when they hit around 6 to 8 years old and can live as long as 50, 60 years in the wild. So you could come back years from now, Nicole, and still see 840. And at that point, he might be nesting. So you could just literally follow his whole course of his life.
Well, Joyce wonders, could you please explain how condor's appearance is different from vultures? What would you say, Tiana, are the most remarkable differences to what we understand as the everyday vulture in terms of appearance?
Well, it's definitely a matter of size on the one hand.
Yes.
If you see a turkey vulture next to a condor, you will definitely see the difference with a wingspan of, like I said, about 9.5 feet versus about 6 to 6.5 feet. That said, if you don't have that opportunity, a good way is looking upwards if you see them flying. Turkey vultures have kind of this more V-shaped wing formation, and they're kind of more tippy. They use the wind a little bit differently than the very large condors. who have a much more even and straight sort of soaring path than the vultures do. The other easy way when you're looking up at them though, particularly, is the condors have a white feathering pattern that kind of starts at the leading edge of the wing, whereas turkey vultures and other vultures kind of have a more on the trailing edge of the feathers. And so that's a clear indication of whether you're looking at a condor or a turkey vulture there.
And Pete tweets, great news. Please give us some examples of condor intelligence. You were also talking about this, Joe, in terms of just the intelligence you can see in their eyes. What are some examples that really tell you and reflect condor intelligence?
I think when I speak to it, I speak to like their social intelligence, these bonds they create with other birds, and then just their knowledge of the landscape is incredible. I mean, you're talking, these birds can travel up to 200, 250 miles in a day. We've had a condor in Big Sur that's been up to Mount Whitney in the Southern Sierras. And she's one of our oldest, actually. That's her nickname is Traveler. But yeah, so these birds have an amazing memory. If they know where to go back and find food, they go, they have these territories. You know, you can imagine navigating the world the way they see it. You have to have, you know, it's probably a different kind of intelligence, but yeah, I think between their social intelligence, their memory, just everything about them, just shouts, you know, just a really smart bird.
Well, let me go to caller Christine in San Jose. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Thanks for the show. It's fabulous.
Thanks. What would you like to share?
When I was a kid, I grew up in San Jose up against the East Foothills, and I had this fear. I learned about condors, how big they were, and I had this fear that a condor would come down and swoop on me and carry me away. I wasn't afraid of ghosts, vampires, anything like that, but my fear was being swept up by a giant condor.
Wow. Well, they certainly capture the imagination, but hopefully the gentle giant that we've been talking about has ended that for you, or ended that for you a long time ago. But that said, Joe, I imagine when you are releasing a condor, you have to be extremely careful, right?
Yeah. Condors are gentle giants, but they will protect themselves. You know, condors don't have talons like you typically see with an eagle or a hawk. Their feet are made more for walking. They can obviously grab a perch on a tree really well, but it's the size is their intimidation factor. They actually can't back it up too much, you know? Obviously if they're backed in a corner, they'll defend themselves. But really their beak is their, when we're working with the condors, and either whether we're attaching transmitters before we release them or checking their blood for lead, we are typically really careful with the head and the beak. You know, obviously they can render flesh through really thick hide. So if they get a hold of us, it usually ends, you know, with them taking our flesh. So we're really careful, and, you know, we have a process that we've kind of perfected over the years to handle them with the least amount of stress. And obviously the handlings are really, really limited because we want to keep the birds as wild as possible. So, condors are for the most part completely harmless. And again, they use that size in the wild to their advantage. They use that big size to intimidate off a lot of animals, whether it's a coyote or bobcat coming up to try to steal their food, you know. So they can just puff up and look big and, you know, scare off most animals. So it's a really good strategy.
My understanding, Tiana, is that while there is a very intricate and careful process for reintroduction, just to also get the land ready for them when the Yurok decided that it was time to reintroduce them to Yurok ancestral territory. Can you talk about the process of doing that as well?
Definitely. So I started out as a biologist. I could go into the years of kind of the feasibility analysis of what we took to determine that it was a good place to bring condors home to, but I won't, because I'll go off on a tangent. Short story is, we live in a relatively pristine area compared to a lot of the United States. And while threats are not non-existent, it's still a pretty good place to live. But the two things that we really did to prepare the landscape was I mean, really, they're kind of the same thing. It was working with the human community to get ready for it. So on the one hand, that meant talking to a lot of our federal, state, nonprofit, industry, land managers out there to say, hey, we're talking about reintroducing this endangered species. What are your thoughts about it? Do you have any concerns? And how do we address those concerns and move forward together in a good way? Which was an incredibly valuable sort of partnership-based approach that just bore all kinds of fruit in making this happen. The other was reaching out to a specific demographic, which is very important to condor conservation throughout their range, which is the hunting and sporting community. Yes. And so Joe briefly referenced it. One of the primary threats to condors in the wild right now is threat from lead contamination, which has been found to come from the use of lead ammunition, which most people we talk to were not originally aware of. I come from a hunting community. I'm a hunter myself, and I didn't know about it growing up. But the issue is that lead actually fragments heavily on impact and can actually deposit in the gut piles that hunters will leave behind after harvesting an animal, which normally is incredibly good food for scavengers and is actually a very important role that hunters play in conservation by providing that food. But not when it's studded with lead, which, as we know, is a toxic chemical or a toxic element, excuse me. So a lot of our work right off the bat was starting our Hunters as Stewards project just to get the word out there about the impacts to condors, but also bald eagles and golden eagles, which people are very drawn to, getting the information out there and asking our hunting community to join us again as partners in condor conservation now that they had this information in hand. And so we had a lot of success with that. And this is something that we did not in any way start. This is something that is very prevalent throughout the condor recovery program. But one of the best ways for us to prepare for condors is getting that lead out of the system in favor of non-lead alternatives, which are just as viable and don't have that unintended impact.
Well, the listener tweets, can you briefly remind us why they almost went extinct? And it really is lead bullets, right, Joe?
Yeah, that was one contributing factor. I think historically, you know, you had to look at a time too when there was a lot of extirpation going on multiple species when, you know, when people were coming from the east and settling the west, and there was, whether it was, you know, there was heavy take on a lot of species, and condors were also a victim of that. But yeah, in the last 50 years, it was predominantly lead poisoning from what we know. And then obviously the last, since we started reintroducing condors, it is the number one threat, you know, since the early 90s when we began. We've been collecting data along the way. And yeah, the research is overwhelmingly, you know, shows, and we just know it. I know from personal experience picking up many a dead condor, life's cut way too short, you know, that have fallen to lead poisoning and, you know, actually have the lead fragments or actually intact lead bullets still in their GI tracts when we recover them. So yeah, it's one of these unintended consequences. And again, the solution is working with hunters and ranchers to switch to the non-lead. And our group, Ventana Wildlife Society, we've been, offering free non-lead ammo since 2012 to hunters and ranchers to help them make the switch. And yeah, and just, you know, educating. And like Tiana said, you know, I think a lot of it is that it's just a lot of folks didn't realize it was an issue. And again, you know, hunting within the regulations, and it provides food on the landscape for condors, just as, you know, livestock does and other forms of food.
Let me go to caller Sean next. Hi, Sean.
Hi, I was listening to the radio this morning, and you guys were talking about the condors. My stepdad, Dr. John Quick, he worked in Morgan Hill, and he was one of the ones that took care of them when they brought them in from the Pinnacles back in, I'd say, what, 2003 to 2011 before he passed away. And it was the coolest thing to walk inside there when they were x-raying them, and then, like, the giant eyeball was looking at me like, oh, it's you who's causing this. I was like, no, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you felt like sorry, go ahead, Sean.
Big, huge birds, and it was just so cool to see my stepdad take care of these just gigantic creatures that he was helping save. It was great.
Wow, that must have been quite an experience. Let me go next to Drew in Fairfield. Hi, Drew. And while we try to connect with Drew, let me go to Carla in Oakland. Hi, Carla.
Hi. Yes, this is so thrilling for me to hear. I first heard about the condors when I was in school in 1965. I was taking biology class, and the professor introduced himself as the leading number one fire ecologist in the country at that time. Nobody had ever heard of ecology, much less fire ecology. And he talked about, at that time, what they believed was one of the biggest factors in the extinction was the fire problem, is that, that there have been no controlled burns in the national forest. And he said, and I remember he said, Smokey the Bear is one of the biggest frauds ever perpetrated on the American public. You have to have controlled burns. And the reason is when these birds eat, they eat 80 pounds of deer meat or whatever, and they need runways to take off. And with the underbrush, they can't do it. So I don't know how accurate that is. Obviously, the lead poisoning is the more relevant issue over time and clearly today. But I am so thrilled to see the captive breeding program being successful and the reintroduction program, because one of the things he said in 1965 was that there were 37 left in the wild. They were going extinct. And at that time, they did not know if they could recover the species at all. Because they believe that at that time there's a certain minimum number of in a herd or a flock that has to be done for sustenance of the species, and he was very worried that they would not recover. No doubt he is not alive today, but he would be so happy to hear about this. Thank you so much for this program. It's very inspiring to what we can do to turn things around in the environment.
Well, Carla, thank you for telling us about him. And Tiana, fire is a concern, right? It is something that can take a condor's life.
It is, absolutely. And actually, the Central California flock, which is co-managed by Ventana Wildlife Society and Pinnacles National Park, has suffered pretty badly over the past few years because of it. And I actually really appreciate, though, this previous commenter, because getting fire back on the landscape is a huge priority for the tribe. Because of its traditional role in keeping these sort of fires down, and further, by kind of almost eco-engineering the landscape, which is something that traditional peoples did, in order to support a huge variety of wildlife. So I know we're not the only ones who are doing it, but one of the ways that we are working towards improving the ecosystem for condors in our area is by reestablishing our traditional prairies, which have been reduced to just 1% of what they used to be, because of fire suppression and because we were no longer allowed to do our traditional burns, and expanding those prairies to be able to expand their access to foraging and food resources and things like that that rely on prairies. But right now, the ever-increasing catastrophic fire in California caused by drought and climate change have had very real impacts on that Central California flock, as well as Southern California flocks, in loss of both adult and juvenile birds, I believe.
Well, Tanya writes, almost 20 years ago, our family went to the Oakland Zoo and they had a wonderful exhibit about condors, including wings that children could try on to show a condor's amazing wingspan. Wow, very impressive birds. Phyllis writes, in the early 2000s, I was driving south on Highway 1 in Big Sur when three condors in formation were flying north. I had a sunroof in my Honda Civic, and the majestic birds flew directly over my car. I was amazed. Just down the road, I pulled over to a rest area for an hour, watched 13 condors on our roof drying their wings from the recent rain. At that time, there were only 39 condors. I felt privileged. We'll be talking more about condors after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Sure. So in addition to where the two locations you've been talking about in Central California and Northern California, we also have a reintroduction program in Southern California, down there based out of Hopper Mountain National Wildlife Refuge. And over in Arizona as well, we are releasing birds in conjunction with the Vermilion Cliffs and National Monument and Grand Canyon National Park over there in Arizona. And those birds actually travel up into Utah as well. And then we have our last release site. It's down in coordination with the Mexican government in Baja California.
Wow. Well, Carrie writes, we're seeing many more condors in San Benito County lately. I'm attaching a picture. A couple of weeks ago, this condor was soaring over the San Benito County Historical Park south of Hollister. We see many other birds here at the historical village as well. Thanks for doing that, Carrie. We'll see if we can get that up on social. But in the meantime, when we think about what they look like, I'm struck by the fact that there is this term for species that are more popular called the charismatic megafauna, meaning that the way they look really does matter in terms of getting people and then therefore members of Congress actually interested in supporting them. Can you talk about where the condor fares on that relationship? Because looks do matter.
Well, I would definitely include condor as one of the charismatic megafauna. You know, as Joe was talking about, the way they change colors, and they are big. They might not be cute and cuddly, but they definitely draw attention. And so, but you know, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is looking to recover numerous species across the U.S. And some are big and some are small and some are plants. And so we do look to try to address all those, and depending on opportunities and partnerships, you know, that often kind of drives how we move our funds and how we work with these partners to implement recovery.
Well, I think this next caller would probably agree with you that they're charismatic megafauna. Joshua in Sebastopol. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, go right ahead.
All right. This is Joshua, the photographer. Joe, it's great to see you on here. But I actually have a question for Tiana. I know that there are four more that are going to, you know, get released soon. I was wondering if there are any plans to release more than that after the next ones get released.
Thanks, Joshua. Tiana?
Yeah. Absolutely. And you're 100% correct. We actually have four more birds, another three males and one female, currently staged within our release and management facility that we have out there. And they are hopefully going to be released starting within the next couple of weeks. And then you kind of do it a staged release, a couple, then another. So over the course of the next month or two. But we hope to be able to release more birds every year, 4 to 6 birds for the next 20 years. And then, of course, we hope as well to be in a few years seeing them start wild breeding as well to grow our population in that way. And we're not necessarily going to stop in any way after 20 years, but we are going to take a pause at that point and see how is everybody doing and what's our approach afterwards. Do we need to keep on adding birds to the population or have they become self-sustaining in some way?
It really is a lifelong commitment, isn't it, Tiana? And so how do you track and make sure the birds are safe and monitor their activity?
Yeah, so every bird is incredibly precious, not only to us individually as managers, but to the population as a whole, particularly because they were such low numbers and are still definitely very endangered. So every bird actually is equipped with a patagial tag, a wing tag that you can visually identify them by. You'll hear me reference my birds as A0 or A3. That's the wing tag that you can see. But they're also assigned a stud book number. So every single bird that's born anywhere is tracked from start to finish. Where they were born, who their parents were, did they have any offspring, were they ever sick, lead contaminated, anything like that. The birds themselves are tracked on a daily basis with both a GPS tag, which gives us a sense of how they're utilizing the landscape overall, and a radio tag that crews will actually go out into the wild and get eyes on birds to make sure that they're healthy and well. So it's definitely a very involved sort of process. We try and catch them up at least twice a year to do physical checks, test their blood, check on their transmitters and things like that, all to make sure that each individual has the best opportunity for thriving that we can give them. And this is just the beginning. I mean, this is the work that we do. There's a whole host of folks out there who do condor treatment as well. There's the breeding facilities where a lot of the, pretty much all of the wild birds come from, if they're to be released into the wild and they're not wild born. Researchers, people doing outreach. There's just an incredible amount of work that goes into making condors recovery a reality.
Well, the listener asks, as a young girl, I remember hearing that DDT was a culprit and caused thin eggshells. Is that correct? Joe?
Yeah, we actually have been researching that topic beginning when the condors started nesting in Big Sur. Condors feed on the coast on marine mammals, which can be a conduit for getting, you know, the source of DDE. So we've been researching it. We did find some eggshell thinning, but our data shows that the eggshell thinning is not at a level that's going to harm reproduction, but we are closely monitoring it. Fortunately, condors mix up their diet. They're not just relying on marine mammals. They go inland and feed on terrestrial mammals. So there's a nice mix happening in the outlook is good. So, but we're keeping a close eye on it.
Well, how often do they have hatchlings? I guess I'm not a bird person, so I don't know exactly what to call them, but how many at a time do they mate for life? Like, what is that process and how long does it take?
Yeah, it's very slow. They lay one egg every other year. And so they spend the off year with that chick, showing it the ropes out in the wild, introducing it to other birds, showing it where to feed, teaching it how to fly, teaching, you know, showing them the locations that have been successful for the parents, you know, so passing on a lot of lessons. And that's really unique for birds. You typically associate that with mammals, you know, with grizzly bears or mountain lions, this long investment in their young. So yeah, that's slow breeding. And, you know, they need a high, they need low mortality with their chicks. So this is another aspect of condor. And yeah, and they have these, they mate for life. You know, they pair up. As long as that mate survives, obviously, they'll stay with that mate for life. So it's it's very relatable.
Yeah, very much. I shouldn't say that I'm not a bird person. What I should say is I don't know that much about birds, because they are just awe-inspiring. And of course, we asked listeners to also share what they thought of condors, and they gave us words like magnificent, majestic, graceful, powerful, and spiritual. Ashley Blackford, given the description of all the partners that need to be involved, the monitoring that needs to take place for how long these things need to take place, and the slow process with which they, understandably, the slow process which they have young, do you feel like the commitment from the federal government will be sustaining and there for this process? That the outlook is good?
Well, I will definitely say that the Fish and Wildlife Service is committed to this program. And thankfully, we have incredible partners that are committed as well. Not just the two folks you have with Ventana Wildlife Society, but Pinnacles National Monument, Yurok Tribe, and the Peregrine Fund as well as all our captive breeding facilities. And so, yes, we, although we compete for funding every year across all those other species, this is definitely, I think, a priority of our region and our agency to continue to work towards recovery for. We're seeing progress. We know how to solve this issue. And so continuing to work towards recovery and getting self-sustaining populations on the landscape, I think, is very achievable and something we want to continue to strive for.
And I love this question from Logan. Logan writes, I know the reestablishing of condors has a long way to go, but how does it feel? How does it feel to see something that is so important to the Yurok people fly in the sky again. I gotta go to you on that, Tiana.
I mean, for myself, as a Yurok woman and a Yurok biologist, I mean, this is definitely, I've literally been working toward this for my entire adult career. This was something that was given to me, to our program, by our elders. And I'm so impressed and in love with them because, like I said, it had been 130 years since condors had actually lived on our landscape. But they and our ancestors had been able to keep that relationship alive through some really hard times. To 2003 is actually when the decision was made and brought to kind of our tribal government, make this happen, bring condors home. And I remember when we first brought our first cohort in, and actually Joe and Ventana, as well as others, were there because our birds had been staged with Ventana until they could come up and join us. We brought out our elders, many of whom had been a part of that original task force who made that decision. And while I have always looked up to them with such gratitude and love, the love that was poured back on me for something that I feel blessed for having been able to contribute to was just an incredible feeling. I also just have a 4-year-old daughter now. And I myself did not grow up, you know, being taught everything about condors because it had been such a long time and because that information had been curated, particularly by our ceremonial families, but not everyone had access to it. And that's why it's so important to have the full spectrum of the species that we co-evolved with, because if you don't have them there, how do you exist in relationship with them, you know? I mean, the point of the story is my 4-year-old loves Preganish, her California condor. She's always asking for videos and pictures and stories about them. And so her world has been changed by the positive work that we and the rest of the California Condor Recovery Program, who laid the way for us, has been able to bring condors back from the brink of extinction. On top of that, just seeing them fly, just take off right off the bat. It was such an incredible feeling. And my heart definitely flew with them when they did.
Tiana Williams-Clausen, director of the Yurok Tribe Wildlife Department. Joe Burnett is also with us, senior wildlife biologist and California Condor Recovery Program manager at Ventana Wildlife Society. Ashley Blackford is with us, California Condor Coordinator and At-Risk Species Coordinator at the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife. This is a fundraising period for many public radio stations. You are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. And let me go to caller Susan in San Francisco. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Love the show, especially today's. I just wanted to point out that you can see condors in the nest up close and personal on YouTube. You can see past breeding seasons, and right now I'm looking at one in Tom's Canyon. Looks like to be number 60. It's a baby. I don't think it's fledged yet because it still has some down on it. And I'm watching it on YouTube. And the other one, all you have to do is go to YouTube and type in Condor Nest Cam. And then historically, they'll have past highlights, and I'm seeing one right now that shows condor number, looks like 90, in the nest with its radio transmitter. That's the adult, and a little tiny down-covered baby. So I think when you see something up close, it makes you care about it more, and these nest camps provide you with that unprecedented ability to see these birds like you were 2 feet away from them.
Well, I'm so glad that it's so fun that you're watching them while we talk about them right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, I looked it up so you would know. So.
Thanks, Susan. Appreciate that. Another listener tweets, what about the Occidental or Russian River area? Would that be a suitable habitat with the estuary and Goat Rock close by? What do you think, Tiana or Joe, the Occidental or Russian River area, Tiana?
Well, I mean, we do know that condors ranged all the way up to British Columbia and that they are an extremely adaptable species. So anywhere really where they can find access to foods and the resources they need, ostensibly they could thrive. So if you've got riverways, if you've got mountain ways, coastal lines, anything with that really robust wind that they can take advantage of, you could have condors there. The one thing that you really do want to consider when you're talking about release areas are, I got to say, the human impacts, from my impression, are there a lot of humans? Because with more humans, you have more impacts. Are there enough resources, like food resources and things like that? Obviously, you don't want to be in an overly developed area, I would think, because condors thrive best if they're wild and free. But anywhere that there's wind, I mean, they could be in the at least limitation of human impacts. And Joe, I don't know if you've got anything to add to that.
And I think in the range, I'm trying to remember, Russian River is not too far south of you, right, Tiana? I mean, that's within the range of the birds you're releasing up there, potentially.
Let me see if I can squeeze in Clive in Woodacre. Hi, Clive, really quickly.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for the show. I was wondering how many birds have been lost to lead poisoning, the reintroduced birds, and if there are any plans to ban or at least limit and control the use of lead in hunting.
Clive, thanks. Joe?
Yeah, I'm gonna lean on Ashley for exact numbers.
Ashley?
Yeah, so we know that we have lost about a little over 50% of the known mortalities that we have been attributed to lead poisoning. So it's a significant portion. When we're addressing lead in the environment, really we're looking for collaborative, proactive, voluntary switching to lead, to non-lead ammunition. California, there is a ban for hunting, but as we're looking for folks in Arizona and Utah, they're all taking the voluntary approach, looking to incentivize. And Joe mentioned earlier how Ventana Wildlife Society is contributing to that effort in California as well. So,
do you have an actual number, just out of curiosity? No, it's okay. But if you have an estimate, or Joe, our producer is asking you to talk about Traveler, who was widowed 2 or 3 times as a result of lead poisoning, right?
Yeah, so Traveler is a 25-year-old female, one of the first birds. She was part of the first group of birds I was part of releasing back in 1997. And, you know, she really tells the story of survival and just resiliency. You know, she's been caught. This was her closest call with lead poisoning. She was on death's doorstep. And thanks to the efforts of Pinnacle's crew noticing there was something off with her when she came to their release pen, and they caught her. And then they were able to get her up to Oakland Zoo. And Oakland Zoo, the veterinarians, and they have a treatment facility specifically for condors at the zoo. The vets there were able to diagnose her and then find out that she was actually more severely suffering from lead poisoning. And then we were able to get her to LA Zoo, and they were successfully able to do surgery and save her.
Well, thanks for your efforts, Joe Burnett, Tiana Williams-Clausen, and Ashley Blackford. And thank you to the Forum team, who are Grace Wan, Caroline Smith, and Susie Britton. This is Forum. I'm Mina King.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Heising-Simons Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.
This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.